Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to our podcast. Thank you for clicking play. I am one of your hosts, Lindsay Anderson, and joining me is
Benny Loy.
My pronouns are she, her.
And I'm she, they.
And we're here to have a good time and tell you the news. And later on, I'm going to interview a super cool member of our community. And then we have a super fun guest. Our writer, Cameron, is going to be on, and we are going to just have some fun with Reddit. So stick around for that. Before we get there, we have some other fun things to talk about because this was a special double issue this week, our travel issue, where our writers got to talk about some of our traveling we've done this year. And I think we are going to get started by talking about our super cool guest later on in the podcast, Cameron, who went to South Korea for a semester and then got to write about it for the SGN. So first of all, shout out to Cameron for these really beautiful pictures. And I asked them in a meeting earlier today, Cameron took it with just their phone. Like, no, I was thinking like a fancy camera or something. It was beautiful. I wanted it as a poster.
They did fantastic work. Really enjoyed the piece.
Absolutely. The descriptions of food made me really, really hungry while we were editing this meal.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I love this. It's such a funny piece too, because Cameron admits that though they didn't ever feel discriminated against for being visibly queer, they did not understand much of the language in South Korea. So if people were like dissing them, they just didn't know. Have you ever traveled to another country, Benny?
I once did a day trip to Canada.
Cool.
Took a ferry right over to Victoria, BC. And I'm telling you, the security over there, we have nothing on their security. I took the ferry from Port Angeles, and the security was so lax. The security guards were so unintimidating. And then I get over to Canada, and I was incredibly intimidated by the Canadians. All their security guards were these giant hockey player-looking dudes. And they actually, like, questioned me on what I was doing in the country. And I'm just like, oh, fuck, like, I had to question my American privilege for a second. I'm like, well, I'm American. You just let me in.
I love that. I went to Canada earlier this year, and they did the same thing. It was really intimidating. They were like, why are you here? And I was going to just like their big mall to like go to the mall. I was like, just to go to the mall. And they're like, who vacations at a mall? And
I'm just here to see your insect museum. Can I please view your stick bugs?
And also, I think it's so funny. So when I was like in second grade, I went to Canada for the first time. And we were learning about Asian countries in my, like, social studies part of second grade. And my dad was like, we're going to a brand new foreign country. It's going to be so different from America. And we drove through, and I was, like, looking. I thought it was going to look like South Korea. I was like, what?
Yeah.
English still?
It's America light.
Yeah.
Not to be mean to any of our Canadian listeners, if we have any. Like, you guys do have a wonderful, beautiful, unique country. But it's not that big of a culture shock for us.
But you don't have mozzarella hot dogs, which Cameron said they have in South Korea. So,
yeah,
I think I need to plan my trip there. It just sounds super fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It really does. And then how was Chicago and California? Those were your two articles.
Yes. So I went to Chicago to see the Restless Leg tour, which was Tina Fey and Amy Poehler on tour, which was amazing because they are two of my like heroes from childhood. And I went with my mom. So it's just like total girls trip. Super fun. California, though, was absolutely insane. Like, and I only got to write about the first half of the trip because then it became too long. So if you are able
to- It became too long for you.
It did. The trip was, oh my God. I decided with my partner that we were going to drive down to Northern California, Stanford, in one day, which is a 16-hour trip if you don't stop anywhere, with our two dogs, one of which was under a year old when we took this trip. The highlights included decimating a Target bathroom in Portland, getting yelled at by a presumably crazy lady trying to cross the street in front of our car in Portland, going to Slappy Cakes, which is super cute. If you ever go to Portland, you get to make little pancakes in front of you on a griddle. And I made mine in the shape of penises. And that was fun. Then getting stuck in Weed, California with some crazy people yelling, like a Karen yelling at these people, these poor diner workers. The police showing up to deal with the Karen incident, putting us way off track. Then stopping at dark to fix our headlights by a creepy cornfield that felt like it was out of a horror movie. Then finally at 1 a.m. getting to Stanford, California, only to find that our Airbnb was literally like a crack house. Like this was, the guy had cars all in front of his driveway, like car parts everywhere. And this guy comes out, he's all buff. He's wearing like a thin little wife beater tank top. And we were staying in the like cabin in the back of their house, you know, like the mother-in-law suite, is what it's called. And he was just like, "You're so lucky that you got here because I was about to go to the gym." And he did not look like he was going to the gym. He looked like he was going to go rob people or something. Intimidated as hell. And then our dogs barked at him because they're chihuahuas and they bark. And he was like, "They better not do that like during the night because I complain about our neighbor's dogs all the time." And I was like, "Okay." And he was also like, "Don't let your dogs outside because there's raccoons twice their size that will kill them." So yeah, it was scary. The whole stay there was scary. It was a very gross little room that we stayed in. And eventually the next morning, I got us a hotel room for the next night. So it's like, no, we can't.
Yeah, yeah.
So, shout out Airbnb for giving us a refund. And word to the wise, maybe just book a hotel room instead of trying to save about $20.
Yes, yes. It's not worth it. Just get a hotel. No. Just eat that bill that you're gonna get. Like, it's better than the trauma.
It is. And you know, when you add in like a hotel that does a continental breakfast or something, like it's about the same price as, you know, breakfast and that Airbnb, especially the fees they tack on.
Yeah. And they might have a hot tub. And sure, Airbnbs might have a hot tub, but I don't recommend it. You don't know how sanitary that is.
So for our special listeners, I'll just wrap up my little story. But for our special listeners that don't get to read this, on the way home, we had just as crazy a drive that involved escaping a wildfire that literally picked up and started while we were exploring these caves in California.
Wow.
Through a wildlife park that was owned by like very conservative people that had Bible verses all over the place that we didn't realize.
You got to be careful driving around those kind of areas.
Yeah, that was almost as scary as the Airbnb guy.
I've had to explain that to my fiance, Lauren, before, where it's like we've been driving around different areas. And I'm just like, OK, we're going to need to be careful. Let's not stop and park here for a while because somebody's going to come out of their house with a shotgun.
Yes. But as scary as that kind of travel is, we've got another travel piece, actually two travel pieces by Sean Hamilton from Dallas Voice about his family's journey to gender-affirming medical tourism in Mexico. And really quick, before we started recording this, me and Benny were discussing, because we both read these pieces. And actually, I read the second one, even though I didn't have to, but I like stayed a little late because I was like, I need to know the epic conclusion to this. And it was one of the best articles we've had in a long time, I think. Really incredible to get an inside look at what this guy went through to get his top surgery. So it is very expensive surgery here that costs upwards of $8,000 in the U.S. It's often not covered by insurance. The parents, Sean and Sean's spouse, said that their kid should really own his surgery. His own, and he did. He, you know, wanted it. It was his healthcare. And she did a lot of research and found the opportunity to do medical tourism in Mexico, where he went to Mexico. He met his doctor. He got the surgery. And then he stayed in a recovery house for 2 weeks.
It sounds like he got better medical care than most people would here in the States. So the article is great for some added perspective that you haven't experienced before. And it's also fantastic if you are looking for those kind of services. I really highly advise that if you're looking into getting any kind of gender-affirming care, like, it's basically like a how-to with the amount of information that it gives you on what you'll be getting, what you can expect, what you can do in Mexico for this. And so I feel like the benefit is really, really massive for a lot of people.
Yeah, I also really liked that he touched on a lot of biases that Americans have about Mexico because of the way that media portrays the country, even like movies where you see the Mexico filter. My partner always points that out, this kind of like yellow, scarier filter put over Mexico. But yeah, that you said, like, he got better medical treatment than you probably would get in the U.S. The accommodation was great. People were really, really nice. The recovery house seemed lovely. I was like, I want to go to a recovery house. Mm-hmm. even like recover from anything, just like recover
just
from.
Just be taken care of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, that's
it
so lovely.
It sounded so sweet.
We've got a lot of other really cool queer travel pieces in this issue that you should definitely check out. We've got Washington Wonders, Exploring the Coast of the Ho Rainforest by Benny, with cute pictures of Benny's dog. A Cruise Around the Arctic, which is a special from Philadelphia Gay News. Nemesis wrote a really cool piece on respecting the land of Hawaii and how Native Hawaiians have really asked people not to travel there, which is really important. And I would highly recommend giving that one a read as well. And one of our newest writers and a buddy of mine, Ian Crowley, wrote about Michigan, which is where his family's from. So yeah, definitely a lot of things to check out here. And really quick, Benny, do you want to fill me in on what's going on with Lauren Boebert?
Bad Lauren, because I have a lot of good Laurens in my life. She recently got caught in a theater getting groped by a date and then also groping him. It's all on camera.
Was this consensual groping?
Of course it was consensual. But
okay.
As a person who, you know, is always, always, always preaching on the values of family values and always talking about how drag shows are the highest form of degeneracy, this is
a lot of degeneracy for her.
Yeah, this is very, very interesting that she'd act like this in public.
Bad Lauren Boebert.
Bad.
Bad congresswoman.
It turns out that her date owns a gay-friendly bar that has hosted a drag show.
No. Bad him. Bad for groping Lauren Boebert.
Yeah.
Just like sleeping with
he
the enemy.
He is not
right
an
there.
Ally, but also,
no.
Like, as we all know, nothing contradictory about these people. They absolutely hold true to all of their values at all times. And then in a really good uplifting note, they have removed the restrictions on gay and bisexual men donating blood. Yay!
Yay! You'll definitely see more about that in next week's paper, too. Keep an eye out.
Go donate blood, please. There's a shortage on right now.
Yes, we want your blood.
Halloween's coming up.
Yes. Come together this fall at Seattle Rep to experience extraordinary art on stage. From Passengers, the immersive storytelling experience by contemporary Cirque Collective, The Seven Fingers, to Islander, the Scottish folk-inspired musical. Then usher in the holiday season with the reimagined classic Little Women, a family-friendly adaptation like you've never seen before. The season begins September 22nd. Get your tickets now at seattlerep.org. Thank you guys so much for sticking around for this wonderful interview. Today, joining me, we have author and educator, Aiden Key. Aiden Key is also the founder of Trans Families, which you can find online at transfamilies.org, and Gender Diversity. And he has a new book coming out this year called Trans Children in Today's Schools. Aiden, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Thank you for all the work that you've done as like a scholar and an educator. And it's such an important topic to discuss, especially as we've seen conservative politicians really pushing back against discussion of transgender identities in schools. So my first question for you is just, you know, as someone that's been studying gender for the last 25 years, how have you seen the general understanding, language, and reception of gender studies evolve?
Well, it's an interesting question that I can't quite relate to unless I change up the wording a little bit. So I haven't really stepped into gender studies. I've stepped into an examination of gender as it relates to me personally, as it relates to the community that I've lived in, as it relates to friends and families and complete strangers. And I've really pondered those questions. And just as a point of clarification, if I'm talking about my own relationship to gender and my gender transition, being assigned female at birth and now presenting as male, and all of the things that have changed as a result, the way that people interact with me, the questions they ask, the intrusiveness at times, the curiosity, the delight, the range of emotions, it's just been really startling and really puzzling. And I spent time, if I'm going to call it gender studies, that's the area that I delved into I'm navigating my life and my relationship to gender, but what the heck is going on for everyone else? And that's where things kind of really have blown up exponentially. And I think that that is, well, not I think, I know that that's absolutely the reason I felt so strongly about writing trans children in today's schools, because I should just say begun to understand some of the complexities that show up and the layers, the societal layers, the systemic layers that are busy rocking in terms of what does it mean to be gender inclusive, and especially as we consider gender outside of just male and just female.
Thank you so much for elaborating on that. I really appreciate that. So another thing about your career is that you have worked on curriculum for K through all the way through college, correct? About gender identity and topics such as that. How might teaching a younger child about gender for you differ from teaching an older child?
It requires remembering what gender is about when any of us were a certain age. I feel like the children are the ones that teach and remind me about that. So it's not hard to step into conversations with children of any age. It's a matter of stepping in, posing some questions or a topic for conversation, and then where do they take it? Mm-hmm. And then following them in their journey. The only difference is bringing in the understanding that gender isn't solely predicated on our anatomical sex. And of course, I wouldn't even use fancy language for children. They provided me the language themselves, which is, you know, who we are on the outside versus who we are on the inside. So an inside relationship to gender is something that they can easily talk about. They usually say things like, well, you might see me as a girl, but in my heart and mind, I'm a boy. Those are the words and the framing that I then provide to their teachers, to their parents, to the school administrators. When they ask, how do we talk to kids about this? It feels too mature. It feels too complicated. It feels like we're talking to them about sexuality. No, no, and no. We just need to step into the conversations with kids and understand where they take it and give them a notion of possibility, which is a notion that I never got, which is you can have a relationship to your gender and have that strong sense of your gender. And again, it doesn't matter what your anatomical presentation is presenting to other people. But now that kind of bucks up against a pretty strong fortress in society. And I think that is where, as you mentioned earlier, the legislative efforts and all of that are bringing up. It feels pretty daunting and terrifying to a lot of people. But I'll tell you what, if you sit in those classrooms, those kids, and have those conversations, there's nothing to worry about. They know how to do it. We need to learn. And all of a sudden, I'm just a very, very busy person because I'm providing that bridge or you know, providing that recollection, I guess, is a better way to put it, for those adults. What were we talking about, any of us, when we were in kindergarten, when we were in fifth grade, you know, when we were in 11th grade? How do those conversations vary? We have the way to engage in those conversations if we just can pause for a second, step out of our panic, and just remember what gender was all about.
Thank you. That was a great answer. I really appreciated that. And kind of bridging onto that topic of teaching gender, or not teaching gender, because we're taught gender from before we're born, but discussing gender and gender identities with younger people, why do you believe it's so important to have these conversations about gender and gender diversity, especially with younger children?
Well, for any of us who might be part of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, asexual, pansexual, any of the terms that describe our sexuality, we're part of those communities. And of course, many of us from older generations, we didn't have room to talk about that at all in our upbringing without serious and harsh repercussions. If we are waiting to talk about those kinds of differences, if we're constantly looking at gender differences in the context of sexuality, then we are insisting that we delay those conversations. Oh, we don't talk about that. That's too mature of a discussion. You have to wait until the kids are in the health or sex ed curriculum, or you wait till they're older, or, you know, when they're adults, they can talk about it. When we're adults, we can come out. You know, I came out at age 19, 18, 19 years old. That's a lot of life to live before actually talking about who I am. And that is the piece that I think we can figure out how to do quite adequately today, which is we can talk about gender and the way we express our gender, because we're busy expressing our gender from our earliest of days. We're doing that by showing our interests in certain things. We're doing that by engaging in certain activities or wearing certain clothing or whatever. So being able to engage in those conversations about gender expression and keeping it about gender expression and not in some sort of peripheral context of sexuality, then what we're doing for these children is supporting them in who they are right then, at that day, in that moment. And we're showing all of the kids a way to be inclusive of various differences, and that the gender expression and gender identity can be part of that easily. If we wait, if we think, as many say, this is too mature of a conversation because everybody's busy thinking about sex, if we're waiting, then what we're doing is we're not teaching kids. Kids are observing those differences and recognizing that there's stigma behind that. And we're creating that climate where those children get teased and bullied and rejected. By the time we do think we could bring it around for discussion, you know, you've got a kid that's 12 years old, 13, 16. Like, when do we get to do that? We've already created that culture where that difference is stigmatized. I want to do something a little different. If a little boy wants to wear a skirt to school, does it have to be earth-shattering news? Can the kid just wear a skirt to school? Why not? It's an article of clothing. When I step in with those young kids and have conversations with them and I tell them, hey, did you know that not very long ago, girls couldn't wear pants to school? They don't believe me. And, you know, they've got members in their family who absolutely have experienced that and know that. Again, I think we can bring those conversations in. If a girl now can wear pants, then why can't a boy now wear a skirt? Does that boy need to be teased and bullied for doing that? No, he just needs to be respected because that's what he chose to wear that day. So it can be really, really straightforward. And what I love about these conversations with kids is that, you know, they're mildly interested in a gender identity question, like being transgender. Like, oh, yeah, my classmate. Oh, well, you know, he's always been mostly a girl anyway. And so it makes sense to them if they then switch a name or pronoun for that kid. They go, oh, yeah, I get it. That makes sense. If we can take those conversations and show how that inclusion and acceptance extends to all the kids for whatever reason, then the kid who is a boy who will, you know, maybe grow up to be a heterosexual man, if he wants to have his hair long, he can have his hair long. It's not girl's hair. It's not boy's hair. It's his hair. So in a way that I really love witnessing is that these kids can connect those dots quite readily. And I think there's a real advantage for all kids in that equation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And my next question for you is that there's a lot of information in your latest book that extends beyond just the school experience of trans children. Why did you choose to include so much in the book?
Good question. Well, based on my experience of stepping in with those educators, they might say, hey, we need to figure out how to have these discussions in classrooms. We need to figure out how to talk to our students. That's what they're saying when they request training. But when I show up, what they actually ask is quite different. And they have all of these questions about transgender people and experiences. They have curiosities about how that a transgender identity might fit in a young person. what if this is a phase? Aren't they too young to know? What if they change their mind? They have all of these questions that, you know, they wouldn't ask of any other kid or family. They would expect that the family is the one that knows the kid best. So because of their curiosities with respect to that, they want to know, what are the medical interventions for kids? When does that happen? How do you know that these are the right steps to take? Shouldn't we just wait till they grow up? I felt like I really needed to put all of that in there. I'd love to hear from more readers as this book gets further in its launch. The journey of adults is what I made my biggest focus. So what are the areas that we get hung up on? Why are we so distressed? Why is there national efforts at legislating against families supporting their children's journey? Why are there efforts to criminalize medical providers who offer gender-affirming care that is supported by every medical professional entity out there? Why are we losing our collective mind on that? That's a much, much bigger question to sort out. And I think, I don't know. Let me give one quick example of where I think this comes from. I don't know how well this example will highlight what I'm getting at. But I stepped in with a group of teachers at a particular school. We had two trainings. And the first one was really just me delving into a lot of this stuff and delineating the things that I think many people have found helpful. So they absorbed a lot. We came back then 2 weeks later, and it was their turn. I said, I want to hear from you. What are your questions? Let's go. Let's do this. And they brought in tons of stuff, very animated. And I think they'd had an opportunity to have the information percolate. They had an opportunity to walk through their day and see where gender shows up and think about it. What would I do differently? And they're thinking about all these norms and things in place. And so to get to the point here, one teacher said, I'm wondering, Aiden, are you advocating for a genderless world? And I could tell, by the way, everybody got immediately quiet and was looking like, oh, this is a big question. And nobody had ever asked me that question before. And I said, actually, no, that doesn't sound like a very interesting world to me, where if it became genderless. And instead, I provided gender full. I would like a gender full world that includes boys and girls, men and women, but also includes any gender diverse person and myself in that mix. And the powerful thing that I saw was all of these faces that were turning to me, intently waiting for what I might say. I watched their shoulders drop. I watched them take in a huge breath. I watched smiles come across their face for reasons that we don't have enough time to delve into now. It was exactly what they needed and wanted to hear. And I think partly because it's a much more accomplishable task, I think, to make more room than it is to try to absolutely erase everything that exists for something new and difficult to imagine. There you go. How about that?
That's a great answer. Thank you. I think it's so interesting to think of, you know, a brighter future as being genderful and inclusive of different expressions of gender. And yeah, that's something that people of all ages should discuss and implement. Yeah.
Yeah. But let me also add that I haven't found that, and I'm going to generalize by saying adults, children do this much more easily. Adults have a harder time getting to a more gender expansive mindset, where they start actually noticing, thinking, and reflecting on gender divisions and thinking about new ways. So one of my constant requests of them is, when you notice those things, ask yourself some questions. Why is this way? We separate by boys and girls for this activity or this situation, or even in our adult lives, there's a lot of gender separations. So instead of saying, why do we do this? Oh, let's discard this. Say, there was a reason for this. What are those reasons? Were there certain goals that were meant to be accomplished to actually better society? And if we can see what those goals were, then we could actually say, oh, well, I don't know, Title IX came about because girls and women were having a very difficult time engaging in athletic activities. There was a a situation that needed to be remedied. So Title IX came about. Okay, well, fantastic. That's about not necessarily gender divisions, but it's recognizing that a pretty significant group of people didn't have access to something that another group of people did, and then an effort to remedy that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of situations that can be applied. And I think those are ridiculously fun conversations. But that said, I haven't found that adults can start getting to those conversations until they, at the very least, understand, viscerally understand the difference between one's gender identity and one's sexuality, for example. Yeah. So that's the work. That's some of the heavy lift that I have to do in my day-to-day work. And when they get there, whoo, how exciting. I watch them brighten up and get excited about where this goes. And let me also say that I watch this happen in politically conservative communities, in religiously conservative communities where a lot of times people will say, well, that's not going to happen. Well, I watch it happen. That's part of my everyday work world, which is pretty dang cool.
Well, that's amazing. What do you think some of the biggest hurdles to gender inclusion in schools are?
There are several things that tap the list in terms of some of the biggest challenges and barriers. And one is politics. One is religious differences. And to a lesser degree, cultural differences. Oftentimes that's raised, but my actual experience is that cultural differences are not as significant as what people might think. But the politics and the religion have crowded into the room pretty significantly. The interesting thing about that is trans and other gender diverse kids come from all walks of life, and they are in Muslim families, Mormon families, Christian families, you name it. They live in all different parts of the country, of course, all different parts of the world, rural and city, conservative, liberal, you name it. These kids are in these families propelling these conversations and making us as a society examine some pretty powerful questions. The thing that's interesting today, and interesting in a painful way, is that the topic has become more and more polarized with respect to faith and politics. And there are political think tanks pouring large sums of money into framing these talking points and stoking fear in a place where what we more need is deeper conversation and deeper understanding. It puts these families in a tough spot. There are any number of families who, you know, come from Alabama and are Republican and are Christian who have gender diverse kids. And they're in a mighty painful place as they try to seek support for their kid or whether or not they even should support their child's gender exploration. I do hope that even in these really negative times where there's deliberate effort to stoke fear and misinformation, I do hope that actually inspires people to step in and learn more. Because when you learn more, you don't get to unlearn that. Your heart and your mind work in tandem to understand that kids need love and support for any experience that they're going through. And that the questions of whether or not their gender identity is a phase are reasonable questions to ask. And we can say, well, it could be a phase. And it could be a gender identity aspect of their nature. We don't have to know that in the moment to love and support them. So let's step in with that first and foremost, and then let's increase the understanding of the world around them so that they don't experience hardship and stigmatizing experiences. I think we'll get there. And I can be optimistic as an almost 60-year-old person watching decades of progression. I'm optimistic while at the same time deeply pained by what's happening today because I know that lives will be lost because of what's going on today. But my hope is that we move through that as quickly as we can and that we get to a place of greater understanding so that we can get at what we all know, which is kids need love and support.
Yeah, thank you so much. So you kind of mentioned that one of these major hurdles is the politics that has really sprouted up in recent years around gender identity. And I wanted to know, why do you think we're seeing so many legislative bills seeking to deny the support and inclusion of trans youth?
Part of me wants to say, I have no idea. I don't understand what's going on. This is just kind of mind exploding in the whole idiocy of it. But on the other hand, what I see and feel is what I consider a small subset of the population that is trying to be very shrewd and is trying to motivate a political base and taking advantage of the overall lack of awareness of our society on the needs of gender diverse kids. And if they can strike those chords of fear and concern, then they can motivate a political base. And it really is as simple as that. If it's been interesting because to witness these legislative bills, for example, because it's always couched in concern for these kids and their families. And if there was true concern, then why would they not listen to all of the professional entities that talk about the most supportive practices, which are stepping in and affirming their identity, affirming the support of their lives, rather than denying that and denying them the care that they need and denying them the family support that is so crucial? It makes no sense when you look at it. So I don't know. Here's a thought. Over 15 years ago, I started the first parent support group in the Seattle area for families of gender diverse kids. And they would ask so many of the same questions. You know, what if this is a phase? What if they change their mind? These kids, they're too young to know who they are. And they'd ask those questions with a lot of fear and apprehension. They would look at each other and nod and shake, you know, nod their heads up and down like, yeah, I hear what you're saying. And not one of them actually felt like those were legitimate questions. What am I trying to say here? They didn't ask the questions in a genuine inquiry kind of way. They were almost more like statements. And those collective statements say to those parents, we really shouldn't move at all because it could be a phase, because they're so young, because they might change their mind. My message to them is go ahead and make movement. And what is that movement? Well, that movement is loving and supporting your kid, listening to them as they're talking about who they are, stepping in more and giving that supportive environment. And if it is a phase, okay, it's a phase. Let the phase play out. And meanwhile, that kid who is moving through a phase received the love and support and encouragement that they so need for any type of engagement they're doing in their lives. Yes, they are too young. In general, these kids are too young to support the massive oppression that is being heaped on them. That is why I want those parents in the room. That is why I want these teachers to step into these conversations, because we as adults need to shoulder this massive and complex burden so that these kids can just be kids.
And we're back. That was a great interview that I did.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, super great. And now joining us at the end of the show is super amazing SGN writer / social media god, Cameron Martinez. And Cameron is here because they introduced a really great idea for our podcast where me and Benny are going to read Am I the Asshole threads on Reddit, and Cameron is going to determine if we are the asshole. These are not things that we've actually done, but we will try to really give life to these readings. Cameron, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I didn't realize I was a god. That feels nice.
It should, yeah. I think your social media skills are very godlike. They're beyond my capacity. But I guess you're the youngest staff member, aren't you? When were you born?
I think Rowan might be younger than me.
Okay. Rowan's like 2002, right?
I'm 2000.
Oh, geez. Oh, that hurts me.
Benny, when were you born?
In the late 1900s.
Wait, same.
Give a year.
1995.
That's not bad.
Oh, I know. It still breaks my brain that anybody could ever be born after me and be an adult.
I'm a 99 baby. If I live to be 101, I will live in 3 centuries. And that is something Cameron can't say. That is my roast for you.
Okay.
Yeah, you were not a 90s kid, Cameron. You don't understand.
I think I can live with that.
I can't really claim to be a 90s kid either.
You're like way more of a 90s kid than me, though.
No, I'm only 90s in birth date alone. I spent the 90s in a tiny little desert community where I had no access to pop culture. So I learned about like Britney Spears when I was like 10.
Oh my God, wait.
Which was 1885, right?
Okay. Benny, do you want to be the first reader?
Oh, sure. Am I the asshole for telling my sister that our parents don't have to agree with her relationship? My 21 female sister isn't accepted by my 29 male parents for being gay?
I think the poster is supposed to be 29 and male.
Oh, I was like confused for a minute. I'm like, wait, but their parents are gay. They've got two dads.
And also, they're both 29. The parents are 8 years older than the sister.
No, it's been a long work day. My brain isn't working. Throwaway account so my family can't link this back to me. For some context, my little sister is a lesbian. Our family does not support her decisions, but I don't give a fuck who she sleeps with. When she came out, she was distanced from the family, but we started talking again after finding out our father is dying. After things in the family being rocky for a long time, we decided to get together at my parents' house. My dad said he wanted to put all of the drama and bickering aside, and if we have a problem with each other, we can wait until he passes. Everyone agrees, including my sister, so I was expecting to have a nice family barbecue. My family wanted to meet my sister's girlfriend and insisted that she brought her over. We were all excited to meet her. My sister's girlfriend seemed like a nice girl, but she was very standoffish. She kept to herself and didn't speak much to my parents and me. For the most part, she was glued to my sister. This caused some awkward silences. I started asking about their relationship. How did they meet? How long have they been together? And I even joked about if she hurt my sister, blah, blah, blah. My parents started acting stranger by each question. I asked my mom what was wrong, and her response was, "This isn't right." I could tell my sister and her girlfriend were uncomfortable, and my dad tried to calm my mom down. My sister, probably fed up with being treated like shit for the last few years, spoke up and asked my parents what was the point of inviting them if she wasn't going to be okay with seeing them together. This caused my mother to explode with anger because she felt like my sister was being disrespectful. My mother goes on to say a lot of other things that I'm not going to say because I will be banned. My sister started to cry and hyperventilate. Her girlfriend starts to comfort her and tries to get her to calm down. And this causes my mom to tell her that if you're going to be dramatic and act like a child, you need to leave. You're upsetting your father. Before my sister could respond, her girlfriend is grabbing her things and taking my sister to the car. I tried to rationalize this whole situation with my parents. They were no use. They thought she was putting on a show in front of her girlfriend to make them look bad. They proceeded to say that they're allowed to be uncomfortable and feel differently than her. I explained to them that this is who she loves. No one has to agree with it, but we should still love her. I've tried talking to my sister about the whole situation, and apparently I defend our parents too much. I told her that our parents don't have to agree with her relationship, but they should. She told me that I'm being an asshole for expecting her to pretend it's be someone else just because our dad is dying. Am I the asshole? Okay, so the answer here is yes.
Yeah, I think so too, but I'm also like such a people pleaser that...
The thing is, though, is that like just because she's nice to her sister while the rest of the family is not, like, doesn't detract from the fact that she is defending her parents. I don't know. It's one of those situations where I feel like you'd have to put yourself in the shoes of the other person. You know, like, she needs to literally ask herself, what if I was the gay child, right? And then my sibling wasn't standing up for me and wasn't making it clear that, you know, if they're not treated right, then they don't get to have a relationship with, you know, the kids, either of them, straight or gay. I don't know. That's just me.
Can we talk about how much of, like, assholes the parents are? Like,
yeah, the parents are the big assholes in this story.
Yeah, like, yeah.
So first of all, they invited this girl and her girlfriend over, and then they were like, this ain't right. We can't have this.
Yeah, it's like they were looking for a fight or something.
Not in my Christian household.
That really sucks that the dad's dying, though. Just, you know.
What does that have to do with his daughter being gay, though, is my question.
Oh, yeah, nothing. I think it sucks for her that she, like, has to be, disattached from her father while he's dying. Because, like, I would feel so much guilt about that. But, yeah, the parents are the assholes. The sibling, also kind of an asshole. I agree.
Like, I'm glad that they're nice to their sister. But
yeah, it's like, that's not enough. That's very, performative.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, it's just like, I don't agree with these terrible people and their actions, but I'm also going to, like, continue a relationship with them. They're terrible. I don't know. But we don't have the full context, so. And we're also very biased.
Do we have another am I the asshole? Here, I've got a good one. Am I the asshole for queer baiting? So I, 22 female, went to a bar with two of my friends, Leah, 23 female, and Emma, 22 female. We decided to go to the bar to just have a fun time and just hang out with each other. Before I get to the actual story, I would first like to tell you that Leah is bisexual, so that later on makes sense. So we arrive and we get to the bar to pick up some drinks. When we're waiting for the bartender to make the drinks, a random guy stops me. He started to introduce himself and I wasn't really feeling it, but I decided to introduce myself as well anyway to be nice. And of course, he started asking me if I was single or if I was looking for anything right now, and I told him that I wasn't. When he heard that, he started to shift the conversation, but then quickly started to ask me again. I told him no again, and he kept pestering me, asking the same exact question. I think it was about 3 times in where he kept asking me, so I literally just cut him off, and I told him that I wasn't straight and I wasn't into guys, especially him. He just said, oh, and then finally walked off. My friends were behind me the entire conversation, and they heard everything. I was relieved that he finally just left me alone, and I turned around to see my friends and to see if our drinks were ready. When I turned around, I saw Leah's face. She looked annoyed and also somewhat angry. I thought that she was just annoyed that the drinks were taking a long time, so I didn't think anything of it. After we went outside to wait for our separate Ubers, we all said goodbye. Emma was the first one to leave, and then it was just me and Leah. When I saw my Uber, I told her goodbye, but she didn't respond. She instead told me that I was disrespectful for saying that I wasn't straight and that I was queer baiting just so I could get a guy to leave me alone. After she said that, she walked away from me, even though her Uber wasn't even there yet. Later that night, I sent to the group chat that I thought tonight was fun, but only Emma responded. Leah is typically the person to respond very quickly, but she didn't. So I think she's ignoring me for that incident. I feel bad on how I handled the situation, but I felt like that was the only way for him to actually leave me alone. Am I the asshole here?
No, not the asshole.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I don't think that's queer baiting.
No, it's not. There have been like multiple instances where like my friends who are straight have been hit on by super creepy guys. And I'm like, oh yeah, she's with me. She's with me. And they just play along with it and it's okay. It's like girl code. I think they should just know that.
I'd pretend to be somebody's partner in a heartbeat to get a creep away.
Yeah, I think the only time it's, like, an asshole to pretend to be gay at the bar when you're not is, like, if you're doing it for the male gaze.
Yeah, like, I thought this was going to be a story where she, like, pretends to flirt with her gay friend, you know? And then, like, the friend got, like, caught up in feels and stuff like that. Like, yeah, in that case, you would be kind of the asshole. But in this case, nah.
Not an asshole. Cameron, you want to take one?
Am I the asshole for stealing a community cat? This past May, I adopted a former feral cat. Let's call him Snotty. That's an interesting name, okay. For this thread, my son's idea, not his actual name. Why does the cat have to be anonymous? Okay. A backstory. My cousin Stella, 42, lives on a large property and has wanted to build a catio for pets for a while. She had to wait, however, because she was worried about Snotty and a couple other strays harassing them. Literally climbing onto the backyard porch and hissing them from the glass doors. She reported them as nuisance animals to animal control and was advised to set traps. She caught Snotty, got him checked out at the vet to make sure he wasn't someone's lost cat, and came up with nothing. Now Snotty was very sick. He tested positive for FELV, and they were considering putting him down. This is where I came in. My dog had passed away back in November, and our house was very lonely without an animal. I had taken care of disabled cats before and decided to take a risk. I paid for all of his vet bills and was finally able to take him home on May 20th. For a former feral, he's friendly, and he loves my 5-year-old. I often will catch them hanging out, watching television, or sleeping in his bed. The only time he fights me is when I try to give him his medication. Stella called him recently. She said she was getting heat from her neighbors. They had caught wind of her traps, took them long enough, and demanded she return their community cats. Apparently, they were feeding the local colony and got attached. My family's just as attached. I went on our town's social media group, explained that Snotty was already adopted and living the best life. There was no way in hell he was becoming homeless again. I got dogpiled on. One mom said I made her kids cry. Another that I took the only happiness keeping their elderly parent alive. Wow, dramatic much? Some lady kept spamming my messages until I blocked her, calling me transphobic slurs. So Reddit, am I the asshole for refusing to return a community cat? Sorry, no cat tax because I'm pretty sure the person I'm talking about frequents Reddit. This is probably going to escalate the drama anyways, but I want plausible deniability. Okay.
What do you guys think?
Missing a lot of context, but if we are to believe everything they've written, they're not the asshole.
Yeah, I don't think so.
If the cat was sick.
It sounds like the cat was going to die if it wasn't taken in by somebody. Not only that, if this person is setting out traps, okay, they're an asshole. Like, and it's understandable that somebody would want to take the cats in and try to protect them from this psycho.
Also, like, feral cats have a significantly shorter lifespan than, like, domesticated or indoor cats. So she's doing the cat a favor, I think. I don't know. It was a former feral cat, so I'm biased here.
Gotta love those feral cats.
Yeah.
It's extra special when you make friends with them because they're wild.
I think my issue with this is they're dogpiling on this person for taking in the sick cat, but not on this Stella lady for setting up all the traps.
Yeah, that's true. Her cousin's the big asshole here.
How many cats were going to get put down or have been put down because of these traps? They should have put in effort to make sure that they could get adopted.
Should we bring up the old man that's just hanging by on a because of a feral cat?
The literal child who's crying about it.
His life is ending because he can't see a cat who's literally dying every day on the streets.
Send pictures of the cat. Like, maybe that would be it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I think this has been a very successful first round of Am I the Asshole with Cameron Martinez. So thank you so much, listeners, for sticking around. If you have your own Am I the Asshole questions, please send it in and we will read it on the air and tell you if you are an asshole.
Could be fake, too. I like all crazy stories.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Make it up. Give us all the tea. Pretend to be a celebrity. That would be fun. This has been a great episode. Thank you so much for listening. Y'all are beautiful people. Please kiss your dogs for us. Bye.
Radio SGN is hosted by Benny Loy and Lindsay Anderson and edited by Daniel Lindsley. The music for the show is provided by TRG Banks and Jesse Spillane or was provided for free by Anchor. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on sgn.org. This podcast is part of the Seattle Gay News Podcasting Network.